with Leach, Frank, 20th of December, 1965.
Just for the record, what were the areas in which you did the land settlement?
Kerningall was my, mm-hmm. Northwestern province was my main area, but I did I trained in Sabragamour a little bit. You see, one used to go out with senior settlement officers when you were young, and one went to Sabragamour or Kerningall or somewhere like that. Or,
yes, with whom did you go out?
Well, generally with the senior settlement officer, who was Archibald or Stace, or Waite, I think, was one time.
And would you say,
generally speaking, I was in charge of the Northwestern province for most of my time.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that in the LS department, land settlement department, because of this sort of training, precedence counted for a lot?
In precedence in
the practice in what you
well in all government service precedence must count a lot because a government can't afford to treat Mr. A differently from Mr. B.
No, I was not against that as such, but I was wondering whether the policy or the practice which you followed was something you got from paper instructions or from what you had picked up on the field from others?
Well, policy was, I mean, it was general to all. I mean, the main idea was that you settled the village. Well, see, what you were doing, you were marrying two claims, the Crown claim to the land and the village claim to the land, which was really a right of user rather than
ownership.
And if you go back, I mean, in history, the main basis was that the land belonged to the Cingalese king. The successors of the Cingalese king were the
government.
Well, then when the draft was administering the country early in our occupation, they didn't bother about land. And land wasn't, this dry land wasn't worth anything. Nobody wanted it.
Yes.
But then when tea, coconut and rubber came in and started giving commercial value to the highland, more than the paddy land.
Yes.
Well, then people started, speculating came and people started buying, what in law you might say, well, rights of user. Well, it was our policy to settle the land on the villages. I mean, there are different classes of village, you've got to remember. There's what you might call the chain of village, where it was not much good dividing up the land and giving them in blocks, because they couldn't cultivate it other than as a chainer. And it was no good in giving them. I mean, I'm talking about things in Anuradhapura, right in the north of Anuradhapura, or the northern part of the northwestern province,
that's right.
Where chainer cultivation for some years was the only possible, because the soil was so poor. But you had to allow for the extension of gardens and things, intensive cultivation. But otherwise, further south, where the land could be cultivated, the tendency was to divide the land, the chain of land, up according to the inheritance of the various clans. In other words, it then, in those villages, it became a gigantic partition case.
Yes, I see. And now the ordinance helped the settlement officer to claim the land as crown and then to divide it up as he wished.
The thing you've got to remember, it was a very difficult job for a settlement officer because he had no judicial function. The system was that everybody, you put a notice who claims this land and claims had to be received by a certain date. Well, owing to the inheritance, I mean, a large tract of land might be claimed by a certain family, another large tract. So one man might claim 1,000th part of that tract, not a particular bit of it, but an undivided share of it. And that tract would cover everything. I mean, planted land and everything else in that area. So, and roads and things you wanted to keep for roads and reservations. And the way you settled the village was you had to get an agreement from every claimant in consideration of my being given, sold, or what it was, so many acres of this,
you give up the...
I withdraw claim to the rest. And if one man stood out, that village could not be settled.
Did that happen often?
Oh, sometimes, not very often. Because the alternative was, then you came onto the ordinance and said, right, is this land crown or not? Mm-hmm. And then you had a referred it to court, a case against that man in court, which, unless there was some other thing like a sadness or something like that, the crown won, but it took a long time, and you still couldn't deal with the other villages until then. By the time that case was settled, half these people had died, and lots of heirs and other people had to be substituted and all that sort of thing. But that was a fundamental thing. There was no judicial thing about it. You had an agreement with everybody. Mm-hmm. But that is their share.
I see. And so the question of deciding whether it was crown or private only arose when people were obstinate in this sense.
Yes, you went on the fundamental basis that it was crown. Mm-hmm. But then you were prepared to divide it up. Not necessarily the whole land, because you'd probably keep up your sleeve a bit, want it for a school or something
right.
Or forest, might be kept as a forest reserve, and road reservations, stream reservations, things like that. It depended on the population of the village. Mm-hmm. I mean, in some cases all the land would go to the villages. In other cases you might give three quarters of it and leave some in reserve. In other cases, a large extent, if you satisfied there was enough for the villages, some might go to outside capitalists. But the settlement officer didn't sell the land outside capitalists.
Yes, you just reserved
it. His job you reserved, and later on it was passed to the government agent.
Yes, I see.
And of course in later years that then became a mapping out. It was done and provided land for the future. It was the GA's job to map out, although later on, as far as I remember, the settlement officer gave recommendations in his report.
Mm-hmm. Which would generally be followed.
I think so, yes.
Mm-hmm. This process of defining various claims, say you decided to settle a block on Punchi Singho, was that in fact a proper title?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Indefeasible title.
Indefeasible title.
You've got to remember two sections of a settlement officer's work. One is dealing with land which had not been planted, which was under 5 years age at the time of survey. That came under the land settlement notice, under norms. Other land, which was intermediate, was sold by the Crown as Crown land without being declared land under the ordinance. So, normally speaking, you had people varied on this, but I usually had my land sale first. Mm-hmm. Then if there was a dispute, brothers claimed it, planted, and they might have claimed some of the unplanted land, I would withdraw it from sale and leave it. Mm-hmm. Then later on, as you know, that if one brother planted the land, the other brother still had an equal claim to it. Mm-hmm. So when it came to the settlement land, I'd say, right, well, if I'll agree to sell this to Brother A, he will get so many acres of the unplanted land, you see. Mm-hmm. He agrees to it. So one used to work in the sales, not under the ordinance, in conjunction with the settlements under the ordinance. So you did then try and divide it according to inheritance. Mm-hmm. I mean, you work out a whole family, what was it, angle, pedigree, or whatever it is.
Yes.
And work out the shares of each person.
Person.
And that he was entitled, I mean, his mother married so-and-so and he inherited from so-and-so. And then eventually, what had been sold, I used to go to the land registry, check up all the deeds on these lands and find out who sold land. Mm-hmm. And then try and work out what the shares were. In other words, it was like a partition.
Partition. Didn't you find these Kenyan marriage laws rather complicated
matters?
Well,
it was complicated in the sense that it always messed up the settlement because it was the planters and land speculators who always went and bought land from a Diga married woman or the son of a Diga married woman who really had no
claim to land.
And they would try and prove that she was married in Binna or something. It's all hearsay evidence, but one had to go going that's to... That's why these people used to buy up these doubtful claims from somebody who really had no title. And yes, they were of the family, and then for 5 rupees or a basket of fish or something, and get in possession, there they were, you see.
Did they also sometimes buy up a whole block of land from one of out of 10 owners or something like that?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Mind you, the village wasn't quite so innocent as
yes.
people think. I mean, T.Y. Wright would probably grumble on this one. A planter would buy from one owner of tract of land, and then they'd wait 10 years or something till it's nice rubber, mm-hmm. and say, "Come along, you bought this from my brother. I have an equal share." You see?
Yes, I see.
And then get 100 or 200 rupees out of the planter, and then another year later, somebody come along. But those two brothers had a third brother, now and their children. Well, of course, the planter couldn't go to court because having bought from one brother, he opened the door to all the others, so yes. It was open to blackmail.
But this is where T.Y. Wright, of course, is wrong in the sense that he pretends that he checked up and got a definite title when in fact, quite probably, he had only bought from one brother.
Well, maybe or may not, but of course it still goes back to whether he was right in buying it at all.
But what strikes me is that sometimes the planters were quite foolish in this sort of thing. What was essential for them was security of title. And they yet went and bought land on a very...
But they got possession. And planted the land.
Yes, but still, it's on an insecure basis.
Well, yes, subject to settlement, but if the land's worth 1,000 rupees an acre of planted rubber,
mm-hmm.
it's worth giving somebody 100 or 200 rupees to get rid of that bit of tattle and so on.
Yes, I see.
And don't forget that these planters were not the estates. I mean, they're well-known speculators who used to buy up this land, and they'd then sell it.
Yes, intermediaries.
As individuals, then sell it to the States. Thornhill, G.K. Thornhill was a really well-known man in Sandringham.
Oh, I see. And, of course, were there a class of what you would call Sydney's land brokers?
There were certain proctors who sort of specialised in land and that sort of thing, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel that even other proctors, sometimes having villagers bring cases to them, the villagers were so poor that they got into debt over this, and the proctor secured the land.
I think that that did sort of happen.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I know one case where I was selling a land, the proctor appeared and bought it, and all the claims for the land were in Kernigal waiting his arrival for a case. He'd got them all in Kernigal on the day of the sale and bought the land.
Can you remember who he was?
I don't think I can, he's a Kernigal man. He was well known as a rogue, but I can't remember.
Jatiruka?
Frank.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait.
There are two brothers, but I can't remember.
Reverting to this land settlement work, what about Chena land? How did the villager establish his right to a particular plot of Chena land?
He didn't. Because villagers didn't have a... Oh, you mean as a garden, do you mean? Or what?
No, if it was Chena.
No, he... Unless he'd bought it on a deed an individual villager normally did not claim a particular bit of land. He claimed a share of what they called a yaya, a stretch.
He claimed a share as a...
Of the whole stretch.
Of the whole stretch, village stretch.
I'm talking about a village where Chena was cultivated,
yes.
as Chena.
Mm-hmm.
Because you divided it up into, they would clear 20 acres and then divide that up.
Yes, I see. The whole village would clear 20
yes.
acres and then divide that up.
Or they might just clear an acre here and an acre there, but it wasn't his acre, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I see what you mean. But that is in the northern parts. But further south, even in the more fertile areas where they had paddy fields, weren't there supposed to be chainers attached to these paddy fields?
Well...
At least theoretically?
Theoretically, yes. I'm very doubtful about this myself, because if you look at any developed village and follow the paddy fields and then follow the highland adjoining it, it's generally only about an acre. If you can imagine the depth of a square acre,
mm-hmm.
maybe. Much of the highland, if you follow ordinary, it didn't seem to go with that, what they call the appurtenance to the paddy field. But in the northwestern province, they got an agreement from government, I forget this is the Gaygor thing, mm-hmm. that there should be 3 acres of highland to 1 acre of paddy land.
Yes. Well, that was the general practice in the 19th century everywhere, at least 3 acres. Some places it was more.
But I don't... I haven't seen much evidence of that going in the records of the villages themselves. It's when the chain began to have a value of its own, the part that this sort of doctrine came in.
Yes, that's in the coffee period.
Yes.
And, certainly in the 1840s and 1830s, the officials believed that they were entitled to at least 3 times the amount. This is throughout the Canadian province.
Yes, well, it was only, I haven't got the date of it. It was Chilao something or other. I mean, they got the government agreement to the 3 acres.
But that was only in the northwestern province.
It only applied in the northwestern province as a settlement. What it was that we offered to get, I was a settlement officer, get all these claims, and then I'd say to them at the beginning, now I can give you so many acres mm-hmm. of land free, a settlement claim, but I'm not going to divide it up. I'm not going to give you any title to it.
Oh, you gave it to the whole village?
I'm just going to say the Crown doesn't claim it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other hand, if you like, we can go ahead in the other way and I can divide up all your share. In the case of the northwestern province, it charges about 15 rupees an acre or 10 rupees an acre getting up to the Marho district.
Mm-hmm.
15 is a rule, which was far less than the cost of even the landmarks on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Crown grant. I will then divide it up according to your claims, and that will save you from litigation for years and years over these lands. And if you got anywhere south of Warriapolla, they would generally prefer to have it settled that way.
Divided up,
you see.
Mm-hmm.
And it was astonishing, I mean, going back years afterwards, because I have a good visual memory and I could remember villages. You know, by looking at the plan, I could remember what had happened. You would find that where your villages had divided it up, the things were prosperous, grown, planted up with coconuts, because
mm-hmm.
it's adjoining the coconut estate areas. The other villages where it had not been divided was still chaina.
It was still chaina,
yes.
I see. And,
well, mostly, I mean, you would get some planted.
Where it was not divided up, was there a greater tendency for quarrels to develop?
Just the ordinary land cases going on for years and years, of course.
Mm-hmm.
One strong brother plants up more than his share, or some brother plants it up and another brother claims half, or whatever it may be.
Since you had a bit of experience in Sabalgamo, what happened to chainers there? Could they claim chainers as appurtenance to a field or as private?
No, I don't. I'm afraid I only sort of went to Sabalgamo in my early days when mm-hmm. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
No, I've dealt with lands up in Trincomalee, I dealt with in Hambantota.
It is a question of 30 years occupation. I was wondering how it was applied to chainers in places like Sabalgamo, I see. I mean,
I think it would be the same generally speaking, that occupation by chainer cultivation wasn't regarded as against the Crown, you see.
You see.
As a right of user.
But, so that meant that it was decided, they generally... defined it as Crown land.
Defined as Crown
land. But what if an individual needed it?
Yes, but you see, you've still got to divide the country into those which are dependent on chaina and with no hope of, foreseeable hope of turning it into gardens or not. Now, in Sabalgamo, the population pressure and land pressure was so large that there was no sense in keeping it as chaina cultivation. So generally, it was then divided up.
Mm-hmm.
Among the claimants.
And these chainers were being turned into gardens.
Turned into gardens, yes. Mm-hmm. Particularly, see, you notice, I mean, in the northwestern province, I can say, anywhere near the coconut estates where the people worked on coconut estates, their gardens would be developed on estate lines.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, in Sabalgamo, tea, or rubber, as the case may be, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be economically developed, and they would prefer to have their own subdivision.
Reverting to this question between 5 years and after 5 years, I was not very. I didn't clearly understand you there. If they hadn't been using it for more than 5 years, what did you do to the land?
but not more than 5 years, yes. It was then brought under the Land Settlement Ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
The Land Settlement Ordinance, you couldn't bring anything over 5 years under it.
Yes, I see.
You see, the point of the 5 years covers the cost of survey, because mm-hmm. whenever an area was going to be surveyed for land settlement, there was a tremendous rush of planting up and claiming
naturally.
So you still brought that under the ordinance,
mm-hmm.
if it was Chena then. And that was why you had a habit of lots of sales of 20-year-old coconut trees used to be planted. And so when the settlement officer came around, the survey description say cocoa 20 years. You see, what would happen? I mean, they didn't get away with it as far as I was concerned, but you'd have an old garden here.
Yes.
And Chena there.
Yes, I see.
Well, with a small bribe to the surveyor, that would be surveyed like that.
Yes.
Containing 1, 2, 3.
Yes,
three.
I see.
So the description of that was garden containing cocoa 20 years or 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Equally, they might. I mean, I used to go around sometimes, and I'd see people putting in trees 15 years old. You know, dig them up and plant them. So that,
yes,
hoping they'd take root, and in 2 or 3 years' time, when the settlement officer came round, there were established trees there. But you couldn't bring under the. I mean, I'm speaking from memory, but I don't think you could bring under the ordinance anything which was over 5 years
mm-hmm.
old and planted.
So, what happened then to the land over 5 years?
Well, then you advertise it for sale as Crown land.
Over 5 years? No, this is under 5 years, but
no, over 5 years you advertise for sale as Crown land.
Mm-hmm.
And normally speaking, I mean, you either, as I say, you either sold it, and if you had a dispute, you might be able to say, I mean, disputes can be all kinds of things, but I mean, supposing it was just a matter of two brothers claiming it, and one brother planted it, and the other admitted it, and well, you might make a note or either postpone the sale or make a note to allow more to that brother when you came to settlement.
Yes.
Generally speaking, it was agreed amicably.
Mm-hmm.
And equally, the other thing was, when you got these, what I call these dubious claims, I mean, people prospectively claimed it also, then again you'd probably postpone the sale until you'd had the settlement of the village, when you
mm-hmm.
you had all the deeds before you, you see.
Yes, I see. When you say that a land was brought under the Land Settlement Ordinance, what happened then? It was Crown land.
The Land Settlement Ordinance, you see, the land was surveyed.
Mm-hmm.
You then published a notice in the Gazette and in the papers saying that this is brought under this ordinance, that
yes.
the land is claimed by Crown. Anybody having a claim to this land must present it in writing mm-hmm. by such a 3 months or something like that. Well, then those all came in, they were all registered as claimants, and then a settlement officer would go out somewhere near the village and hold an inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
A settlement officer had already been and inspected every lot in the village first.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what you did first. You went and inspected every land, noted down the names of any claimants while you went round,
mm-hmm.
described the land,
mm-hmm.
what age cultivation it was. And I say, if you had these odd fake cases where somebody slip something to the surveyor,
yeah.
Well, in that case you just have to have that resurveyed.
Was that, did you find that happening often?
Oh, quite a lot, yeah.
So the surveyors were open to bribes then?
Oh, I think so, yes. Mm-hmm. And not only that, mind you, there was the genuine case. There's also the case of the old garden, which had gone out of...
cultivation.
Out of cultivation, but one could tell, generally speaking, by looking at it, by the line of the village, by the way that the village had gone. And, of course, you always compared any old plans of the village as well.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in some parts of the northwestern province, there were areas which had been surveyed about 1910. And this is sort of the country between Chilau and Kearney Gore, I mean, that area there.
From where do you fish these plans out?
Oh, we had cut them. Oh, you've got all the... You took all the land records of the village from the country.
Mm-hmm.
Any settlements, any cases, and of course sometimes there'd be law court cases which you'd get from the law court, so you could read that up. You see, that also gave you a lot of insight into
mm-hmm.
into claims and
yes,
things like
course.
That. They're generally wrong, I might tell you, the cases were.
The decision?
Yeah.
That's because they're made on the bench and not on the
field? No, it's because you were dealing with one little bit of land. I mean, I'm not saying they were wrong on the evidence before the judge.
Yes, I see.
But you see, a judge has got dealing with one bit of land, which is salvage. Did somebody produce a deed? Somebody produce a deed. Mm. But when I, for example, was dealing with a whole village, I've got all the deeds except for the old part of land, all the deeds of that village before me.
Mm-hmm.
From that, I can work out these pedigrees. You see.
Yes, I see.
And what the shares were, and from that you and time after time, I found the court case wrong. Not that the trial was wrong, but
the evidence
was on insufficient data, you see. When you've got to, because if somebody suppresses something or doesn't produce it to the court or they don't know, it doesn't appear.
Don't you think that this sort of land settlement work, if it had been done in the 19th century with an itinerant, you know, body like the LSOs, a lot of trouble would have been saved?
Yes, it would save a tremendous amount of litigation, and no doubt about it. Mind you, I still say there's a lot of litigation, because the main trouble was to get ahead of the development, if you can understand.
Yes,
that's why we had settlement going up in the northwestern province, the north of the northwestern province, as well as the south. I mean, you take...
Yes, I was wondering how the department, the heads of department, chose which areas should be were to be settled and which areas were...
It was a matter of... you see, you've got to remember, it's much easier to survey a large chain of area in an unsettled village, so you can get a large quantity
mm-hmm.
done. So the settlement officer, in consultation with the government agent give his view, the settlement officer go out and look at it, because he might, in some area, there was so little crown land left that it wasn't worthwhile surveying all the villages, you see.
Would that apply to the Kandyan province?
Oh, yes. I'm regarding the northwestern province, most of it as being Kandyan. It was, you see.
No, I mean the Kandy district area was not settled.
Well, that's probably because it was also completely occupied and settled for many generations that there wasn't any crown land, and they probably deal with bits of forest by itself, you see, not settled over it.
But wouldn't it have been helpful for a settlement officer to go in there and to unravel the local claimants, and in
but
that
you
way...
There was no power for a settlement officer to interfere in the private land matter. It was either crown land or not crown land. If it wasn't crown land, he'd got no power to deal with it at all.
But what about in the northwestern province, for instance? Say there were about three claimants to a patch of land which was private. You couldn't do anything in that area.
Yeah. All they can do is they can go to the court. I mean, that's all. There's no.
But what if the deeds which you had gave you an insight into who the proper claimant was?
Time and time again have I found land cases wrong. In fact, on one occasion, I remember finding a land case. This was a bad land case. I remember reading the evidence of the case. It all pointed to Mr. A being the owner, and the judgment was given in favour of Mr. B. That I sent back to the Attorney General and asked him to look at it, because I don't know, one never knows whether it was bribery or sheer and honest mistake, but all the evidence in the case led to Mr. Sonson. I mean, one can't do anything except put it right by balancing something, you see. Saying to that man, look here, you've got away with murder on this one, we're giving more to so-and-so. And in front of the money, in front of the whole village knows it, you see.
Yeah.
They're agreeing.
Yes. And while you're in the field, for instance, if you found that one chap had been cultivating a patch of land on and off, say, chain iron first, mm-hmm. and perhaps having a few jack trees and things, for 25 years or so, would you settle it on him?
No.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I mean, this 25 years, after all, you can't guarantee within 5 years, one probably say it's private under the 30-year rule, you see.
If it was established as as cultivated for 30 years, he got a prescriptive
claim. Yes, but I mean, after all, one didn't argue between 25 and 30 years. Mm. I mean, you see, one looked at it and said, well, that looks to me as though it's had 30 years. And I say, you've also got to go into the configuration of the village, what looks as though it's been settled, you see.
Mm-hmm.
You don't normally find a bloke miles out from anywhere else having a thing like that. If it was adjoining an old garden, you'd give them the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do know that you gave them the benefit of the doubt. Yes. How did you settle it on him? Was it a CQP?
No. Oh. No, that was a thing dealt with only by a government agent. There was no power for a settlement office to deal with CQPs.
Mm-hmm.
No, one gave a crown grant. If you settle, you just say it's private, I'm sorry. As far as I'm concerned, when we finish the bill, it's private or crown, you see.
And do you mark it private, Mr. Singh, or so that it...
No.
It won't?
No, it's private.
But wouldn't it have helped him to have a sort of prima facie proof if someone else contested?
No, because one hadn't gone inquired into that land, one hadn't found out whether any other claimants.
Mm-hmm.
It may be in possession of it, but time and time again you get a proctor with a nice flourishing coconut garden. He ends up by owning a third of it and you sell the rest to some of the other villages.
How did that happen?
Because he jumped in on bad claims, on bad title. I don't mean bad crown title, but bad village title.
Bad village title.
And just by sheer force,
And so you claim it back for the crown and then sell it to the village?
I mean, the settlement, I get that man to sign in consideration of being sold...
Oh, I see.
20 acres at 200 rupees an acre, not 15. He withdraws claim to the rest that he's planted.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to convince him, I say, you can't judge it, you've got to get him to agree, and so you've got to say, well, there's the case.
So, would you say that it was the policy of LSOs to protect the village and villagers from these outsiders?
Oh, we delighted in interesting the tales of these speculators, couldn't stand any...
But how effective was this in practice?
Well, it was... it was effective to the except where the man was in possession.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could...
If he could prove cultivation for 20, 30 years...
Oh, well, we didn't interfere then at all. But I'm talking about younger possession than that. I mean, the man had been there 10, 15 years. You couldn't deprive him of the whole lot. I mean, it was a matter of making some adjustment, saying, right, you can have half at such and such a price or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was generally better for him. I mean, he had half with a good title, and having lots of lawsuits tied up with it all.
And you felt that some of these speculators were unscrupulous in the way they got the land?
Oh, they did. I say, generally speaking, it was getting hold of some meagre married woman and getting, either through her or her children, getting some paper title. Well, then they start planting up. It's no good taking a criminal case against the man for criminal trespass, because all he does is produce a deed and the court says, civil case, you see.
Would you say that it was your partly because of your success in deterring the gains of the speculators that you got this political attack on the LS department and on land policy?
I think partly that, yes.
Mm-hmm. So you feel that some
I think of... I think there's a certain amount of genuine. See, these lands had developed a strong paper title from way back to about 1840, 1850.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it had been going on, and people had been operating that when the crown hadn't paid a lot of attention to these chain of lands.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about the remote chain of lands, because that was kept under control with chain of permits.
Permits, yes.
But I'm talking about the nearly occupied village, I mean, fairly well-developed villages and all that. And so you had developed a title, and it's quite like a man wants a bit of land to own his garden. That's the only way he could get it, other than by applying to the Crown
for
purchase, when he got no guarantee he'd get it. The thing's put up to auction, and he applies for it and put up all the money and everything else, and deposited 3 rupees an acre, and then when it's up to auction, he may never get it. It was a very bad system.
Mm-hmm. But you felt that some of the politicians who were criticizing government were speculators themselves and had an eye?
Well, I don't know which came first. They were, after all, they all want land. The Singhalese wants land. It's the only way they got land was to do this way, even prepared to settle later on. If they're in possession, rightly or wrongly, they would obviously want the Crown not to interfere in most cases, you see. And they would want the land private and say the Crown shouldn't. It's just a moot point. I think historically the Crown was right, and economically I think it was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you were subsidising a partition case. You were good, government didn't make money out of it.
Yes. I was wondering how far these politicians and these the articulate public who were criticising government represented the villager.
Well,
was it a grievance on the part of the village?
I think they came to accept it. My experience is, but I don't know that. I mean, villages were organized against this, and I can understand villages feeling the Crown was jumping their rights. I mean, it's quite an understandable thing. Generally speaking, I found it accepted as a thing that had to be gone through by the villager, and generally speaking, they preferred to have it divided up and save them from litigation. I mean, one used to talk to them, and they were sensible, and that was the outcome. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that it was all, it was a lot of trouble inspired by land speculators who wanted to have it their own way. I don't think, no, there must have been some feeling behind it.
Mm-hmm. No, I was wondering whether these critics were acting in response to a village grievance, or...
No, I think it was more
agreements.
What I might call agreements, inspired agreements by the etiquette people and the lawyer. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't, I wouldn't go as far as say that any certain sense of villagers, they didn't feel that it wasn't an interference because they'd been left alone with it so long.
Mm-hmm. There was a certain amount of grumbling.
I think so, mm-hmm. Yes. But I found that when it came to the settlement, it was accepted and welcomed because, as I say, in the northwestern province, I had to offer them three times the extent of Penland private.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, they preferred to settle it. In the poorer district where even they couldn't afford 10 or 15 rupees, they'd say no, and they'd take the risk.
What happened to a chap who didn't have any pen land?
Oh, I didn't. There was no question of saying you've got an acre of paddy there, you can have 3 acres of paddy. And all we said was, there are 100 acres of paddy in this village, you can have 300 acres of cheddar private, and I'm settling those areas private.
Mm-hmm.
The rest is Crown.
But south of Waripola, they preferred to get it divided up, didn't they?
Roughly speaking, mm-hmm. There may be individual villages where they...
Well, if they wanted to divide it up, and there was one chap who didn't have any paddy land, but yet claimed
well,
Chena.
There was no question that the highland belonged to the paddy field owners.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all these things had got divorced years ago, I mean, by sales and marriage. I mean, the two economies had got divorced. All you had pertinent to a paddy field was a threshing floor or something like that.
So
what happened in the old past, because the highland had suddenly acquired a value more than the paddy.
So it just depended on the claimant?
It was a pure physical size of the village. I mean, how mm-hmm. much highland there was, cheddar land and paddy field, and then whether the claimants preferred to have it partitioned, that's what it amounted to.
Mm-hmm. What about before the land settlement officer came on the scene? How far were AGAs and GAs trying to prevent these incursions by speculators? Were they trying?
Oh yes, but it depends, very much depended on the headman reporting an encroachment or,
mm-hmm.
Then they would take a case against him, and then the man would produce deeds to show it's his, and the courts would... the criminal court would say, there's a civil case, you see. So then the GA would then have to have the land surveyed and do a little independent settlement on his own, so to speak. In fact, in the northwestern province, it was very common there, I did quite a lot of this, where a man with a large claim, probably where he claimed it on a sanus or
mm-hmm.
something like that, would apply for the settlement of that area. I mean, it was done like that.
Mm-hmm.
I can give you a rather amusing story about that. There was one RM, Madhavapala, who claimed a village or two. Where was it? It was north of Kernigal on the Anuradhapura Road. Not the Dambulla Road.
Oh, Dambulla Road.
Well, I had been in the land settlement department, and I did a year in the medical department. Then I went to the land settlement department for about
mm-hmm.
3 months before I went on leave.
Yes, I see.
Now, in that 3 months, they said, here's an application from Mr. Madhavapala for a settlement of this area, and he paid the survey fees or something like that, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out on a preliminary inspection. That is, I got his claim, what he claimed. I then had to inspection for giving instructions to the survey department as to what to survey. Well, this is all rather like Cassandra Gamble, jungle covered hills, low lying hills. Mm-hmm. So the man in Paul was about 60 at the time. And so we said, right, we'll go around the boundaries. And so we went around the, I mean, the boundaries were, you know, on the east by a spookle tree and on the north by the brook with the shining face or something like that. And anyhow, we walked up these ridges and round Sand Trank Toddy and went round these ridges and said, that's your claim. He said, yes, that's my claim. So I then located it and gave instructions for the survey. Went on leave. When I came back, Land Settlement Department. Oh, the survey, Mr. Manipola's survey, in survey. And I went and then this is about four times the air, taking in another range of hills and everything else, you see. And I said to Mr. Manipola, I said, that's a bit curious. We walk round these bounds, and shall we walk round them again? No, I don't claim that. But he persuaded the survey, you see, to extend that considerably during the survey.
There's been a criticism, or at least, couldn't it be said that the LSD should have worked in closer touch with the surveyors on the field?
It's a matter of time. I think we did work very closely in touch. There was a period about 1910 or 12 when it first started, when there was quite a lot of enmity between the two departments. I think that was when Fraser was settlement officer and the surveys weren't very good and they...
Yes, I see.
They were always sending stuff back and they got rather warfare, but they were very friendly relations in my time. I don't know that there was, because I used to go around an area before it was surveyed to give general instruction, what areas, I mean, what form of survey, because some villages, you could tell by old plans or going around, there was hardly any crown and it wasn't worth surveying it. So one might say, well, cut out those villages, that block of villages.
Oh, know. I see.
Or only survey road reservations or something like that, you see.
But generally there was no contact in the field, was there?
No, because it took time, you see. I mean, surveys that worked to a plan according to the weather, and then they go up to Dirtalawa and work it out in the field.
Oh, I see.
And that sort of thing. You see, and then what happens, having got the plans, you get a batch of 40 or 50,000 acres of plans. Well, then all these... You get what is called a tenement list, that is a sheet describing every lot. Lot number one, name of the land, extent, claimants. Well, in the office they had to write up what they called field books. All this information had to be copied down into little field notebooks. Well, then, when those were ready, then you went round the village and inspected every lot of land, made your own notes about it. And then at the same time you read up the cut tree. You collected all the village files. Well, there'd be quite a lot of information on these claims, particularly in the Candon areas, doing a particular lot of land or stretches of land or that sort of thing. You get a lot of notes. Who were the claimants in 1870 and all that sort of thing. You get a lot of information.
Mm-hmm. After you had settled a village, how effective do you think your mapping out process was in keeping speculators and land buyers away from the village?
Oh, well, once after the village had been settled, you're talking about, what are you talking
individual
about?
Individual settlement.
The Crown land or what? I mean,
Now you had settled it on private people.
Yes.
There was really nothing to prevent them falling under the temptation of a board of notes and selling this title.
No, I could do that and understand that.
What about the...
Except, you've got to remember that the Sinhalese would rub his own grandmother of land. I mean, land is what he wants.
Yes.
And so they don't normally part with their land, except in they might mortgage it, or the mortgage the crops. But it's a last resource to sell the land.
Did you find occasions when chaps sold a part of their land in order to get capital to develop the rest of it?
That might have happened, I don't know. See, what I found was that after all we were charging, 10 rupees, 15 rupees an acre? I mean, it was more than that in some parts, but Sabra Gamo perhaps, but I'm talking about the villager, not the, you charge more to a...
For the speculator.
For the speculator or the man from outside. Generally speaking, they could cultivate that and get that. I mean, in fact, I found that you kept a few acres, what we used to call charity acres, when you're dividing this up roughly, allowing for roads, reservation things. You got the odd widow who got nothing left, but she was a villager. Even quite often, those were not cultivated. I mean, where they had to pay for the land, they scratched it, made it pay. It was a sort of blessing in disguise, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I noticed that you have very wide powers, which I think is a good thing. But do you think that one of the reasons why politicians attacked the department was because you had these wide powers and certain speculators could never know what sort of price they would be charged for the land they had cultivated?
Well, that's probably true.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a land commission.
In the mid-1920s, there was a land commission.
Oh, I think wasn't there one later than that? At any rate, at one stage, it was decided that, I think this was when Selenaika was minister in the Donemore.